Hello, everybody, and welcome to Sports Talk Chicago's Opening Day Special. My name's John Zagluel, owner and operator of the site. We have a lot to get to today, some Cubs Sox news and a special guest, but first, just a few quick announcements. Make sure to follow us on Twitter at ChiTalkSports and hit me up personally on Google+, LinkedIn, and Instagram, all at John Zags. And finally, if you're looking for a place here in the Tinley Park area to buy some sports apparel, you can go to Moochie World, a peculiar place, gift shop, and more. Its address is 7913 171st Street in Tinley Park. You can call them at 773-796-8224. Again, that's 773-796-8224. Well, everyone, it's here. Opening day is finally back. The Cubs are 1-1. The Sox 0-1. We'll get to them both in a moment. But I'd just like to say and express my gratitude at how happy I am that opening day is finally here. The MLB season is now in full swing. It's a great time to be a baseball fan. Well, let's start off with the Chicago Cubs and talk about them. Now, I mentioned that they were 1-1. They had a very exciting opening day game on Sunday night. I don't know if anybody was able to catch it, but just what a game. A lot of clutch hitting from the Cubs late with Wilson Contreras, but the Cardinals in the end were able to pull away after a walk-off single by Randall Grichuk. Now, despite that devastating end result, the Cubs did come back in Game 2 of the series, winning 2-1 after some outstanding pitching by Jake Arrieta. He went 6 innings and gave up only one unearned run. So, could we be seeing the Jake Arrieta of old, a guy who won 20 games, won the Cy Young Award in 2015? Now, that is still to be seen, obviously, but it's still an encouraging sign and a great start to the season by Jake Arrieta. I want to break down the Cubs now for a moment because it is still opening week. There's a lot of, not question marks, but things that should be discussed. First, let's talk the starting rotation. Now, here it is according to MLB.com and the Cubs' official depth chart. Number 1 is John Lester. Number 2 is Jake Arrieta. Number 3 is John Lackey. 4, Brett Anderson. And 5, Kyle Hendricks. Now, my question is, why is Kyle Hendricks the number 5 starting pitcher? I don't know if anyone recalls from last season, but he was a finalist in the NL Cy Young Award race. He had the best ERA in all of baseball. Why is he being treated like a Jason Marquis, per se, a career-long number 5 starter? Now, I understand that Hendricks maybe doesn't throw the hardest, and he has still not amassed 200 innings in a single season. But after the season that he put together in 2016, you would think that he deserves a promotion, maybe a number 3 or even a number 4 spot. Why is he being punished by being forced to stay in that number 5 hole? Now, of course, there has to be an explanation for it, and I'm sure over time as the season progresses and Hendricks continues to do what he's doing, that it's probably best to keep him in that spot. But it was just a question of mine. I mean, again, considering what he did last season, because it was a special year, to say the least. On to another rotation storyline, and that's the fact that Mike Montgomery is not in it. Brett Anderson is in it instead. A lot of people might be asking, who is Brett Anderson? Well, I'll tell you, he's a very good pitcher when he is healthy, and that's the key word. Anderson has never pitched more than 181 innings in a single season, which is what I mean by him having some health woes. He has not made 30 starts since the 2015 season, but he's played 8 years in the MLB, and in those 8 years, he's only had 2 seasons in which he has made 30 starts. Now, despite those injury-plagued seasons, the rest of his 6 years of his MLB career, he still has some pretty good statistics to his name. His best pitch is a slider, and that's something that hitters have long complained about, is that it's so electric, it moves right when it crosses the plate, so that could explain why at age 22, despite having Tommy John surgery that same year, he went 7-6 with a 2.80 ERA for the Oakland A's. That could also explain why with the Rockies in 2014, he posted an ERA under 3 in 8 starts, which, again, is something very hard to do, considering that their home field is Coors Field. By taking on Anderson, the Cubs are certainly taking on a risk, the risk that he could get hurt once again. But if he stays healthy, that risk will turn into a huge reward for the Cubs. To make things even better, the Cubs only paid him $3.5 million for 1 year. If he doesn't pan out, he leaves after this season. But if he does, the Cubs just gave up minimal money for a very good pitcher who can help them down the line. That's something very important to consider. Another waning question mark for the Cubs going into this season was the center field situation. Dexter Fowler had left, gone to the Cardinals via free agency, so what were the Cubs going to do in center field? Well, they signed John Jay, and they're going to use Albert Almora there as a platoon situation. I want to go over both guys and what they bring to the table, starting with John Jay. Now, Jay has been around since 2010. He has spent most of his career with the Cardinals, only one with the Padres, and now he's here with the Cubs. Jay in his career is a .287 hitter. The problem is he doesn't have a lot of power, only 31 home runs in his career. Now, despite that, the question remains, why was Almora playing before Jay? Shouldn't Jay be starting, considering he's the veteran presence? And no, I disagree with that statement. Albert Almora is the better player here. Now, although their offensive statistics are quite similar, Almora, not that big of a power hitter as well, his defense is way better than John Jay, and case in point, look at the game last night. He robbed a home run and pretty much saved the game for the Cubs late in the seventh inning. Those kinds of theatrics are what we could see from Almora on any given night. He's so much more athletic and a better defender than Jay, which is why Almora is playing over Jay. Could that change? Certainly it can. But as of right now, and hopefully for the rest of the season, Almora is the better player, thus he will get more playing time in center field. Look, make no mistake, the Cubs do have some question marks. Although they are minor, they are still question marks. Despite that, I'm going to say that the Cubs are going to win 98 games this season, make it to the World Series, and win it again. Yes, that's right, I am saying it. The Cubs are going to become a dynasty, and they're going to go back-to-back here in 2017. With the Cubs and their analysis wrapped up, I'd like to switch gears here, go to the South Side, and talk about the Chicago White Sox. Now, the situation there is much different than the Cubs right now, but if we go back to the Cubs of 2011 or 2012, per se, their situation is quite similar. The Sox are rebuilding, and there's no doubt about it. We saw it in the offseason when the Sox decided to get rid of Chris Sale in order to get Yoan Moncada. The same goes for Adam Eaton leaving to get Lucas Giolito. So, it's apparent that they're rebuilding, but what does that mean for this season? Well, I'll say right off the bat, it's not going to be the best one. A gaping hole the team needs to address right now, at least to say functioning, is the starting rotation. If you look online in MLB.com's depth charts, the Sox only have four guys in their starting rotation. They're still looking for a fifth. Quintana is the number one, and rightfully so, although he might get traded later on. The number two is James Shields. Number three, Derek Holland. Number four, Miguel Gonzalez. And as I said before, the number five spot is vacant. So right away, we can decipher that the Sox are going to have pitching troubles this season. I mean, James Shields being a number two after what he did last year when he came to the Sox, I mean, it was horrible. And he finished last season with a combined record of 6-19 with an ERA of 5.85. I believe that was the highest amongst all qualified pitchers. Derek Holland was good for a little bit with the Rangers, but he's been susceptible to some injuries over the years, and last year posted an ERA of 4.95. By the way, those years I'm referring to about Holland being good with the Rangers was more so in 2011, 2012, and 2013. 2011, he went 16-5 with a 3.95 ERA, and in 2013, although he did go 10-9, his ERA actually got better, went down to 3.42. So, Holland has had some success at the major league level. Heck, he went to play in the World Series with the Rangers at one point. But right now, like I said before, Holland has some injury problems, and he hasn't been able to really recover fully. Holland is truly an X-factor, a dark horse for this team. I kind of compare him to Brett Anderson for the Cubs. Both these guys were signed for one-year deals for not a lot of money, and their situation is both risk or reward. Holland could come on and have a great season and replicate his 2011, 2012, or 2013 successes, or he could perform like last year when he had an ERA near 5 and went 7-9 and struggled with command issues. Of course, time will tell whether Holland's acquisition was worth it or not. Now on to the fourth starter, which is Miguel Gonzalez. Now last year he was with the White Sox and did fairly well, even though his record doesn't indicate it. He went 5-8, but his ERA was 3.73, and he made 23 starts. His problem was injuries later in the year, but he actually had a pretty good season. And in his career overall, he's had some solid seasons with Baltimore, if you want to discount the 2015 year. So Gonzalez, I don't have a problem with. I have known him, I've watched him since he came up in the MLB and made some postseason starts for the Orioles back when they were good in the early 2010s. So I think Gonzalez brings something to the table, and based on last year's performance, I have nothing negative to say about him. As far as the fielding situation goes, the Sox do have some holes to patch up. Now, something that I was following from spring training was the Sox and their second base competition between Tyler Saladino and Brett Lawrie. In the end, Brett Lawrie lost and he was subsequently released, meaning Saladino rightfully won the job. Now, I think Saladino is primed to have a big season this year. I was not a fan of him when he came up. He didn't do that well either. In his rookie year, he only got 53 hits and 236 at-bats. That's an average of under 230. So I was very skeptical about him. I even labeled him a bust at one point, but I think I was premature on that statement. Last season, he roared back, hitting 282, albeit in 298 at-bats. But still, that's quite an improvement compared to what he did in his rookie year. I think Saladino, who is already good defensively, I might add, can bring something to the table this year with the bat. And if he does that, he could see himself becoming a franchise player for the White Sox, somebody whom the team will not consider getting rid of with this rebuilding process. And in the end, that's all that matters. The players understand what's going on here, or at least some of them do. Some of them know that they're just here to fill the void until the White Sox call up all these farmhands from the minor leagues. So what they have to do this year is perform their best because they might be out of a job next year or in 2 years. Now I'll explain what I mean by this by using an example. I'm looking right now at the Chicago Cubs roster in 2013, an obvious rebuild year for that team. I want to name off some of the players that they used, some of the guys who started the most games at their respective positions. David DeJesus in center field, Nate Shearholz in right field, Darwin Barney at second base. Their top five starting pitchers were Scott Feldman, Edwin Jackson, Carlos Villanueva, and Travis Wood. Think about that for a minute. You can tell right away that the Cubs were rebuilding based on the roster that I just named you. Now, compare that with the roster that the Chicago White Sox have. Their starting rotation, Quintana, Shields, Holland, and Gonzalez. Their catchers, Navarez and Soto. Their right fielder, Avi Garcia. Their DH, Cody Ashe. And their backup DH, Matt Davidson. This is a team that is in the middle of a rebuilding process. Now, the Cubs in 2013 went 66-96. For the White Sox this year, I am going to predict a win total of 68. The Sox are not going to do good, and I'm sorry to be the bearer of bad news, but again, they are in the middle of a rebuilding process. As I've said before with some articles that I've written, this is a good thing. You want to get the bad years out of the way now, so that way later on, 2 or even 3 years down the road, the White Sox will be a force to be reckoned with. Unfortunately for 2017, however, they will not. Now, if you don't like my opinion about the White Sox, maybe our special guest will disagree. We'll be talking a lot of White Sox with him. Let me tell you a bit about him. He was a part of the 2005 Chicago White Sox World Series championship team. He hit over 430 career home runs. He's made 6 All-Star teams, and he was the MVP of the 2005 ALCS. After he retired in 2014, the White Sox retired his number, making him the 10th player in franchise history to receive such a distinction. Please welcome Paul Konerko to the show. So hi there, Paul. How are you doing today? And thank you for being here on the show.
Good to be here. I appreciate you having me on.
So first off, I'd like to talk about your legendary career as a member of the Chicago White Sox. You made 6 All-Star teams, hit over 430 home runs, and won a World Series championship in 2005. For over a decade, you were the definitive face of the franchise. What do you attribute your success to?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of things. I think probably first and foremost, there's definitely some luck involved. I mean, I think staying healthy and being able to take the field every day, you know, is a big factor that gets overlooked a lot. Obviously, your preparation and, you know, your work and your ability to and work ethic to stay in shape helps that. But no doubt, there's some luck involved of just not having any major injuries or anything like that. But I think it's just it's obviously a will to want to go out there and do it, and you know, going through the bad times and the good times, and just keep being surrounded by good people that help you through the bad times, I think, is a huge thing. I was always lucky to have really good coaches, and you know, I think you just keep your head down and you take it one day at a time, and then I think you look up after a certain amount of time and you don't realize it's been 10 or 12 years. That's probably the best recipe to get there.
Now, you were talking about bad times and good times. Now, before you came to the Sox in 1999, you had spent parts of two seasons with the Dodgers and the Reds. Now, in those 2 years, you did not get many opportunities to display your baseball talent, which led to some stats that were not the best by certain means. So how did coming to the White Sox jumpstart your career?
Well, I just think the atmosphere of what the team was trying to do at that given moment, they had a lot of younger guys. They were kind of in a rebuilding mode. So the teams I came from, especially the Dodgers, you know, were more in a win-now mode, a lot of older players, and I just got off to a rocky start, and so you can kind of lose the spot really quick. And coming to the White Sox, I think the difference was is that they kind of made a commitment to play a bunch of young guys, and going into the season, they said, listen, you're going to get 300-400 at-bats, 500 at-bats, and we'll judge it at the end. And so I think that instantly makes you comfortable, and from there, it just kind of, when you feel comfortable, you start playing more like yourself, and then from there it just kind of takes off and, you know, turns into something. So I definitely think the atmosphere of the team when I first got traded over to the White Sox was a huge thing that, you know, that I didn't have in other places.
Now, in 2005, which was 6 years after you first came over, you were really a part of something special. The Sox had won the World Series, and you hit the first Grand Slam in White Sox World Series history in Game 2. To add to that, it gave you guys the lead in the seventh inning, symbolizing how clutch that home run truly was. Did you feel that the momentum of the game and quite possibly the series shifted after your grand slam?
Well, the series, I would say no. I felt like, you know, we had a good handle on it, and I felt like we were going to win that series going into it. And I'm sure everybody, even Houston, thought that as well. But I mean, I felt like we had the better team, and I felt like over seven games we would win that series. As far as the game, you know, of course, anytime you hit a home run, you know, middle to late part of the game, and you take the lead, you feel much better about that game and the momentum of it. But the fact is, they actually came back and tied the game, and we required another home run late in extra innings to win the game. So, you know, it was kind of a seesaw type of battle, but, you know, definitely a great moment. And, you know, besides catching the last out of the World Series, you know, probably my best personal moment for sure.
To follow up, how did it feel to get that ball back before you retired in 2014?
Oh, it was cool. I mean, I'm not much of a memorabilia guy or you know, I'm definitely one of those guys that's just, you know, if I know it happened and I have it in my head, that's kind of good enough for me. But it was kind of a nice full circle kind of thing to close out my career knowing that, okay, here's the ball from 10 years ago that never seemed to make its way back to you, that the team itself. I think more than anything, it was just the team going out of their way like they did in so many different ways my last year. That was just another thing that, you know, was a great gesture on the team's part to actually make that happen. It wasn't so much about the ball. It was about them going out of their way to make that happen, which I'm sure was not easy, along with a lot of other things they did through that year. So that's the thing probably first that struck me, is just all the stuff team did for me that year, including that.
So now, after the 2005 season, there were reports that you were receiving more lucrative contract offers from other teams due to your free agency. So why did you decide to stay with the Sox, and what compelled you to stay aboard? I know you referred to the atmosphere beforehand. Did that have something to do with it as well?
Well, I mean, I think coming off of a World Series, I mean, we had a good team. And, you know, I think there was no sign that we weren't going to be a good team in the near future. So that was definitely played into it. I mean, I think a lot of friends that I made were still on the team, and you know, I was comfortable playing there, and my family I love the city and all that. So, I mean, that was obviously my number one choice, but obviously sometimes the business gets in the way of that. But luckily in the end, it worked out. But that was always the both times I became a free agent, which was after 05 and I believe after 2010. You know, number one choice was always to come back. But like I said, sometimes in this business or in any business, sports business, that regardless of what maybe the player wants and the team wants, sometimes economically it's just not possible. But luckily, it was in both cases, and, I continued on with the career.
In 2015, you became the 10th player in White Sox history to have your number retired by the team, which is a wonderful honor, to say the least. What does that mean to you?
Well, it definitely is... It's pretty cool. I mean, growing up, when you see people have numbers retired, you don't think that's something that, that you could ever do, or, you don't think that you're in that type of, class of person or player, I should say. But I think, more than anything, I wanted to spend a long time with one team. When I come up to L.A. with the Dodgers, my goal was to spend, 10 years with one team. That didn't work out. Then I went to the Reds, and I said, I want to spend 10 years here. And that didn't work out. Then I got to the White Sox, and it wound up being 16. So that was really my only goal, was to just try to spend a lot of time with one team, because I figured if I did that, everything else would come along with that, as far as the production, the contract, anything you want to quantify would have come along if I could just stay in one spot for a long time. So I think the retired number thing is just a tribute to that, and also both parties wanting to go back after the free agency. Like I said, more times than not, it's tough to stay where you're at when you become a free agent the first time. The next time it's even harder. So I think it's a willingness on both sides to want to stay in one spot for a long time, and it's not that common anymore in the game.
Now, since your retirement following the 2014 season, the Sox have failed to make the playoffs, finishing both 2015 and 2016 with records below 500. Now, over the winter, the team decided to begin the rebuilding process by acquiring lots of young talent for veteran players. What are your thoughts on this transition, and do you think that it is necessary in order to bring playoff baseball back to the South Side?
Well, I think, without being there and understanding all the ins and outs of all of it, because I'm kind of away from the game now, I think everything in the game is, goes in cycles, and I think that this is a good move. I think it seems like the timing is right for where the last season or two, what was shown over the last season or two, it might make sense. And I don't think taking a step back means they're going to be, a pushover out there and they're going to lose 100 games. I think in today's game, because every team is very young, that there's no telling that if you put a bunch of young guys together, what could happen. Because I think in the past, 20 years ago or something like that, when a team rebuilt, it was a good chance it was going to take 5 or 6 years to kind of get it back on track. I mean, nowadays you see that a team might finish a couple games out of 500 one year, the next year a couple of years over 500, and the next year win the World Series. So, it can happen very fast. It seems like they've got a lot of great players in some of the trades they made. So my guess is that when it gets good, it'll probably stay good for a while.
Now, you had mentioned earlier that when you first came to the White Sox in 1999, it was kind of a rebuilding process. There were a lot of moving parts. So could you take us through that and how maybe it's similar to the one going on now? Because in your case, it ended in a World Series title in 2005.
Well, that's right. I think it's just, it's all about, when you're a younger player, the environment you're in, and how comfortable you feel to be in that environment. Usually you get the talent out of the person if they're comfortable and they feel good. So, I think they have a bunch of young players now that are all out there, and they'll kind of bond together, and some won't make it all the way. There'll probably be changes every single year. But the core group they got, is kind of the core you want to build around. And, I think today's landscape's a little bit different. Like I said, as far as I think teams, even when they want to rebuild, they're not that far away. I mean, you see every year it's much more common for teams to go from last place or second to last place to win the division next year. So the next year. So I don't put too much stock in the word I guess rebuilding needs to have a different definition. I mean, I think rebuilding now can really happen quickly. I mean, you look at what the Cubs did. That happened pretty quick. Over the span of like 3 years, they now have this kind of battle-tested team, and they're really good. And so, it can happen. I think they got the right manager to White Sox here. I think everybody has spoken very highly of the spring training that was down here in Arizona and run well. And I think he's the right man for the job. He seems like a great baseball man, and everybody just loves him. So hopefully the guys go out and they play hard for him and follow his lead.
Since this is an opening day special, what was your favorite opening day moment as a player?
Well, I think, you always have a soft spot for your first one, just because you never thought and you think about it your whole life. My first one, I was actually with the Dodgers, and I was in St. Louis, which obviously puts on a great opening day, presentation of all the things. So that was a pretty cool one. I think the other one that sticks out is probably, after the 2005 and 2006, because I was back in the team and we all got our rings from the year before, which was kind of cool.
Awesome. Paul, thank you so much for being with us here on the show. I really appreciate it.
You got it. Thank you for having me.
And once again, I'd just like to give out a special thank you to Paul Konerko for joining me here on the show today. Some great insight on the White Sox this year, and a great look into his career, which was a great one, and most likely a Hall of Fame one once he's eligible for the ballot. And with that, that'll be it for us here at Sports Talk Chicago. Make sure to follow us on Twitter at ChiTalkSports, and hit me up personally on Google+, LinkedIn, and Instagram at John Zags. Thank you all for listening, and cheers to another MLB season.